Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Good afternoon.
May it please the court. My name is Heather Fraley, and I represent the appellant, John Snow. I would like to reserve 8 minutes for rebuttal. We simply don't have time today to discuss all of the important issues that are raised in Mr. Snow's briefs, so I'd like to focus the court's attention on three main issues. First, Mr. Snow is entitled to equitable tolling of the AEDPA's 1 year statute of limitations, because he reasonably believed, based on a confluence of factors, that his amended petition would be timely if filed in accordance with the court's scheduling orders. Second, Mr. Snow's trial counsel was ineffective for failing to investigate and present mitigating evidence. And third, the district court clearly erred in failing to give Mr. Snow the benefit of Martinez versus Ryan as a mechanism to overcome the default of his remaining ineffective assistance of trial counsel claims. Unless this court would like to begin elsewhere, I'd like to start by talking about Mr. Snow's entitlement to equitable tolling.
Can we start instead with the procedural default involving the NAPU and Messiah claims? You argue, and assuming we agree with you, that Section 34.726 is not independent from federal law, as applied to Mr. Snow's Brady claim, why should we also find that it is not independent as applied to his NAPU and Messiah claims?
Well, Your Honor, because the facts that went into the Nevada Supreme Court's consideration of all of those claims was very much interrelated. And just as the court would have been looking to the evidence of the state's failure to disclose its relationship with Mr. Morelli in connection with the Brady claim, it would have been looking to that same evidence in connection with the review of whether the Messiah claim was defaulted, and similarly with review of the NAPU claim that the state knowingly presented false testimony as it related to his the fact that he didn't have, allegedly there was no deal given to him. So because the factors that are considered under Brady are so analogous to the factors that are considered and the merits of a Messiah claim and of the Napui claim, we believe, Your Honor, that the default bar would not be adequate as to those either. And in particular, Your Honor, in the Nevada Supreme Court, in dismissing those claims, does specifically state that there was no materiality issue. And certainly the issue of materiality would have been relevant to those other claims as well. So because the holding that there was no prejudice was directly interrelated to the court's assessment of materiality, for the same reasons under Cooper v. Nevin, this court should find that the default bar was not adequate as to those claims.
I have a slightly different question, but on a related topic, and that is, in reading the main text of the opinion, it seems clear that the Nevada Supreme Court is directing its attention to the claims generally, and it invokes the Nevada procedural default rule. And we only get into the materiality that you discuss in the footnote, and the court then seems to direct that footnote only to the evidence that was not available and before the trial court or was available prior to the trial. So I'd be interested in your thoughts as to whether, in fact, if by separating that out, we should look at these different aspects of the claim separately.
Well, Your Honor, I would just simply note that the statement regarding materiality was general when it came to the Nevada Supreme Court, that the challenge evidence was not material generally. So we do think that the court was referring to all of the evidence. But
I mean, I hear you, but then the court really starts out the footnote. We note that some of the evidence didn't exist before the trial, and then goes on and talks about the materiality, it seems to me, with respect to that evidence. So why wouldn't we want to make that distinction as well?
Well, Your Honor, even if the court was to make the distinction that the post-trial evidence was not material, certainly we can demonstrate that the other evidence that was available was material. And that would include specifically the transcript of the proceeding in which Mr. Seaton, the prosecutor in Mr. Snow's case, states on the record that if certain things happen, a favorable disposition would be given to Mr. Morelli on that case. And so that is an example of something that was not turned over to Mr. Snow. He did not have access to, based on the state's open file policy, he had no reason to believe that anything like that existed. Certainly, Mr. Morelli testified that there was no deal. But when we look to that evidence, and also when we look, very importantly, also for our tolling argument, to the evidence regarding the CCDC logs, we see that Mr. Morelli was being visited multiple times by the primary detective in the case. And that certainly goes to supporting our argument that that there was a deal going on. And as to whether the evidence was material, Mr. Morelli's testimony takes up the bulk of the state's penalty phase presentation. And certainly evidence that Mr. Snow had allegedly solicited the murder of one of the state's witnesses would have had a reasonable probability of affecting the outcome of this case, where it was a close call in the penalty phase when it came to the aggravating evidence. The prior convictions that were presented in this case weren't particularly bad. A lot of them were very old. And so when you look to the evidence that Mr. Morelli received a deal, that he gives this very harmful testimony about what Mr. Snow allegedly did, certainly it would have been relevant to the jury's determination of whether death was appropriate and whether Mr. Snow would present a danger in the future. And indeed, I'm sorry, Judge McGee, did you have another question about that?
No.
Okay. And so these same factors, particularly with regards to the materiality of the Brady claim and Mr. Morelli, are also highly relevant to our argument that trial counsel was ineffective in failing to investigate and present mitigating evidence. So in this case, first of all, we have the deficient performance prong, which was adjudicated on the merits by the Nevada Supreme Court. However, we believe that we are entitled to de novo review of that claim, first because the fact-finding process was inadequate based on the post-conviction court's failure to provide Mr. Snow with any sort of process. In addition, we can demonstrate that the Nevada Supreme Court's holding was both an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law as well as an unreasonable determination of the facts. So the Nevada Supreme Court held as to the mitigation claim, and this is at 1 EOR 181, that, quote, the failure to obtain other possible mitigation evidence must be attributed to Snow's lack of cooperation, not to Houston's lack of diligence. This holding was an unreasonable determination of the facts because trial counsel himself admitted at the hearing that he only ever asked Mr. Snow for the names of people that could say one good thing about him. He admitted he never asked for the names of teachers, coaches, prior lawyers, doctors. He never sought out prison records of the prior convictions that he knew the state intended to present against him in the penalty phase of this case. It was simply not reasonable, a reasonable determination of the facts for the Nevada Supreme Court to hold that it was Mr. Snow's fault for failing to provide, basically volunteer mitigating evidence where the record is clear that trial counsel never asked. And that holding is particularly unreasonable when we look to this court's recent analysis in the Andrews v. Davis case, where this court held that where counsel did not need the client's help, it's not reasonable for him to fail to seek out evidence. And in this case in particular, we have a transcript from a 1970 drug conviction of Mr. Snow that contains 50 pages of testimony that could have been considered mitigating in this case. Trial counsel admitted he never tried to get it. He never sought it out. And he certainly did not need Mr. Snow's help to get that evidence, which clearly would have been relevant for him in trying to rebut the state's aggravating presentation in the penalty phase. So in addition, we can tell from the record here, the last question that Mr. Snow's trial counsel asked of Mr. Snow's mother, who was the sole witness who he presented and who testified for a mere 4 pages of transcript, his last question to her was, isn't it true that you didn't know until this morning when I told you in the hallway that you were here to testify in a capital case? In other words, he elicited on the record that she did not know until the morning of her testimony that her son was facing the death penalty. Clearly, it was an unreasonable determination based on those facts for the Nevada Supreme Court to blame Mr. Snow for trial counsel's failure to prepare was clearly below the standard of reasonableness at the time in 1984. And so because we have satisfied the deficient performance prong, this court's review of the prejudice prong is de novo. The Nevada Supreme Court never ruled on that issue. And when we compare the evidence that was presented, which again was 4 pages of testimony from Mr. Snow's mother, which was so uncompelling and so devoid of any evidentiary value that trial counsel himself didn't even reference it in his closing argument. 4 pages of testimony from the mother, never referenced in closing argument. That was it. That was really the sum total of mitigating evidence that was presented. If all we do is compare that to the 50 pages of mitigating testimony that was provided in the 1970 drug conviction, if all trial counsel had done was obtain that transcript and present that evidence, there's a reasonable probability of a more favorable outcome here.
Remind me, counsel, what's in that 70 pages?
Yes, Your Honor. So in that 70 pages, we have testimony that Mr. Snow was raised in a economically disadvantaged area. And that's really critical here, first, because the prosecutor argued in closing in this case that it's not as if Mr. Snow was raised in, quote, the ghetto. In fact, the 1970 transcript explicitly says Mr. Snow was raised in a, quote, ghetto. In addition, those transcripts indicate that Mr. Snow's mother was addicted to diet pills and that as a result, Mr. Snow became addicted to drugs at the age of 12. Despite that drug addiction, Mr. Snow went on to go to high school and to college. He ended up having to drop out of college due to financial constraints of trying to support his children. It was also his attempts to pay child support for those children that led him to get his first armed robbery conviction, which was one of the aggravators that the state presented against him, one of the priors. After that, even after getting out of prison from that, Mr. Snow was able to get a job at Westinghouse. He was fired from that job due to his involvement in a civil rights committee in that business. After that, he received a back injury in 1968, which led him to be given pain medicine. That addiction to pain medicine turned into a drug addiction.
Let me just interject. The reason I asked that question is that, and none of that actually strikes me as particularly compelling mitigating evidence in a death penalty case. Typically what we are talking about there are, you know, issues with some kind of brain injury, some kind of horrific childhood abuse, that kind of thing. None of what you've just described strikes me as particularly compelling on that front. What I do remember being of note was, I gather that your client perhaps saved the life of a prison guard while he was incarcerated, and the jury never heard anything about that. I was wondering if there's something along the lines of kind of that rises to that level that's in those 70 pages, because the background, I remember the background of your client, and again, it's not a wonderful upbringing, but it's not nearly as horrific as what we often see in these cases.
Yes, Your Honor, and I have 3 responses to that. So first, when this court conducts a prejudice inquiry, it has to compare what was presented against what might have been presented. So we're looking at basically no mitigation versus some mitigation. Second, the court must compare the sort of the aggravating nature of the crime itself. And in a lot of the cases like Andrews, for example, where we do have sort of this crazy mountain of mitigating evidence, the crime in that case was so much more aggravated than the crime in this case, where we had a triple homicide involving rape and sodomy. Here we have a murder of an adult male victim by a single gunshot wound to the head. Certainly all murders are tragic, but when you're looking at the prejudice inquiry, it is relevant, the crime, and also the fact that no mitigating evidence was presented. And Your Honor, I would direct you to this court's holding in Smith versus Stewart, which was also a capital case that was tried in 1984. And in that case, the type of mitigating evidence that this court found to be relevant to the prejudice inquiry was precisely the kind of evidence we have here, Your Honor. So in that case, we have this court holding, and this is at 140 F3rd 1269. This court says, quote, "We know that counsel could have at least pointed to Smith's sociopathic personality, his bad drug history, his change in personality after a large drug overdose, and his fine set of family relationships." That was it. That was all that this court had to see to say that there was prejudice in that case. Similarly, here we have the doctor's testimony at the 1970 proceeding that Mr. Snow had a psychotic personality disorder. We have the testimony regarding the disadvantaged upbringing, that he attempted to go to college and have jobs, that he became addicted to drugs as a result of a back injury, and that it was that drug addiction that led to every single one of his prior convictions. And so, again, when you're comparing no mitigating evidence against this mitigating evidence, and you're comparing it against the nature of the crime in this case, not to mention you're looking at all of this stuff together with the harm from the arguments that the prosecutor wouldn't have been able to make here if trial counsel had presented this. And if you look at it in conjunction with the what happened on the record with Juror Buchanan, where that particular juror called the prosecutor during the penalty phase closing argument to warn him that the jury was going to, quote, let Mr. Snow go. So we know from the record that the jury was leaning towards a life sentence. And in fact, it was only after Juror Buchanan made a list of top 10 reasons outside the record why Mr. Snow should be sentenced to death that the jury then sentenced Mr. Snow to death. So when you're looking at the cumulative impact of all of these things, and you're looking at the comparison of no mitigating evidence versus evidence of drug addiction that was stemmed from his mother's drug addiction, of a disadvantaged background, in a case that's not particularly aggravated, we do believe, Your Honor, that we can show a reasonable probability of a more favorable outcome in this case.
Can I ask you a question regarding the Martinez-related claim, please?
Yes, Your Honor.
It looks like in Pellegrini, the Nevada Supreme Court explained that Section 34.726 did not take effect until January 1, 1993. Your colleague, Mr. Connor, on the other side, especially in a 920J letter on the eve of the March hearing date, filed a letter arguing that your client had until January 1st, 1994 to raise his claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel. And I guess I'd like to get your response. Is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, my response is that that argument is waived. The state did not make that argument in the district court below. The state did not make that argument in its answering brief. That 28J letter is the first time that the state made that argument. And so our position is that the argument is waived.
If now, it's not waived?
Yes. So if it's not waived, it is technically correct that under 34.726, the Pellegrini decision in 2001 held that people had until 1 year after the enactment of 34.726. So by the time Mr. Snow was on notice that he could have filed something under that statute, the time had already passed. But the more important point, Your Honor, is that the state's argument fails because at the time of Mr. Snow's first state post-conviction proceeding, NRS Chapter 177 contained an identical time bar. And this court in High versus Ignacio acknowledged that Chapter 177 and 34.726 are interchangeable. So Mr. Snow would have been subject to the exact same one-year time bar at the time of his first state post-conviction. Not only that, he was also subject to the successive petition time bar. So even if he had filed a petition within 1 year of Pellegrini, as the state is now arguing for the first time in a 28J letter, that petition would have been barred as successive.
So whoever determines this Martinez claim, do they, I guess just to ask this in a different way, do they look at the 1986 habeas, state habeas petition, the first one, or do they look at his third state habeas petition in 1997 or in 2000 and the habeas petition filing, the fourth one in 2008, I believe?
Your Honor, this court must look to the petition that was filed in 1986, and that is because whether we're applying 34.726 or we're applying Chapter 177, both of those statutes are clear. A petition must be filed within 1 year of the conclusion of the direct appeal in order to be timely under either of those statutes. So that was the operative petition. That was the petition that mattered. And indeed, the Nevada Supreme Court acknowledges that in the most recent opinion. It says, you didn't file within the correct time after conclusion of your direct appeal. And that's telling, too, as to why the state's argument doesn't hold water. The Nevada Supreme Court doesn't cite to Pellegrini in its most recent opinion in Mr. Snow's case. The Nevada Supreme Court doesn't say in Mr. Snow's 2008 opinion that, well, you had until 1 year after the enactment of 34.726 to file something. No. The Nevada Supreme Court says you are late because you filed 23 years after your direct appeal was concluded. So the Nevada Supreme Court's opinion here acknowledges that the default occurred because Mr. Snow did not file within 1 year of the conclusion of his direct appeal proceeding. And the operative petition, therefore, must be the 1986 petition, at which time he was being represented by First State Post-Conviction Counsel. But in any event, the standards that the district court imposed upon Mr. Snow to prove on the Martinez claim are simply not required under either Supreme Court precedent or this court's precedent. The court in Martinez and Trevino laid out a four-prong test for whether a petitioner could overcome a default of an ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim. None of those has anything to do with anything that the state or the district court is talking about, whether it relates to a causal nexus or whether it relates to an explanation of all of the time that supposedly elapsed between the first state post-conviction and the ultimate filing of the exhaustion petition, which is frankly really irrelevant to this point. And nor has this court. This court very recently in the Smith decision, just in the last month, I believe, applied Martinez to a default under 34.726 and didn't say anything about causal nexus or about the need to explain the entire length of delay. So there is simply no precedent for the district court's holding that Mr. Snow needed to satisfy those things. He was clearly
your view then on Martinez is that there would be a remand and the district court would first apply the appropriate standards.
Exactly, Your Honor, yes.
And then go from there.
Yes, Your Honor, yes. That there will be a remand for the district court to determine in the first instance whether post-conviction counsel was ineffective and whether the underlying claims had some merit. And then it would go from there. Yes, Your Honor, that is our position. So if I may spend a little bit of time here talking about our tolling argument. In this case, the district court dismissed 19 claims and subclaims from Mr. Snow's petition. Among them was a claim that Mr. Snow's trial counsel was ineffective for referring to him using the N-word during his penalty phase closing arguments, as well as the claim I referenced earlier regarding the juror who injected extraneous information into the jury. Mr. Snow has never and will never receive a merits adjudication of those claims because they were dismissed. This court should find that Mr. Snow is entitled to equitable tolling because he reasonably relied on a confluence of factors to determine that his petition would be timely if filed in the court in accordance with the court's standard scheduling orders. As this court is aware,
why is that? Does that remain true after the Supreme Court's 2005 decision in Mail versus Felix? That's what I guess I'm stuck on.
Your Honor, because Mail was not instructive for petitioners like Mr. Snow who were already out of time. Mail was instructive for people who had time left on their clock that they needed to make sure that they filed their amendments within their AEDPA time. By the time Mail was decided, Mr. Snow was already long after time. There was nothing instructive in that case as to what he needed to do.
But you waited 2 years after Mail was decided. It seems like if there might have been some concern about that decision or how to interpret that decision as it applied to Mr. Snow, that perhaps there should have been a motion or some sort of filing with the district court to see exactly where you all stood in terms of time. I'm kind of puzzled myself why something like that didn't take place.
First, Your Honor, because Mr. Snow did not think that his case was being governed by the AEDPA anyway. Based on the wording of the 1997 dismissal order, Mr. Snow didn't believe that his case was going to be governed by AEDPA, and we did brief that the nature of the dismissal order stated that the AEDPA didn't apply, indicated that the court wished to retain jurisdiction over the case. So Mr. Snow didn't think the AEDPA applied to him to begin with. Second of all, he had just been granted discovery. At the time that Mail was decided in June of 2005, the court had just, in April of 2005, granted his discovery motion. And the Senate.
May I ask you about that? I will make sure you've got sufficient time for a rebuttal. I know your time is running down.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So I read those orders, and it seems to me, I mean, this is that in a case like this, you could continue with discovery. People are asking with discovery, but the fact that the court granted discovery makes no substantive judgment, it seems to me, on whether you have a claim or you don't have a claim or you're too late or you should have done it before. So I have some trouble with that argument, and maybe you can dig me out of this hole, because I read and reread those district court orders, and they seem to not be very definitive about the topic you're talking about, or misleading.
Your Honor, the reason that they're misleading is the same reason that the orders were misleading in Sosa and in Williams, and that is because they conveyed to Mr. Snow that if he filed his petition in accordance with the orders, that he would be timely. So when the court granted discovery, it did so on the basis that the state had twice failed to comply with prior discovery orders that had been issued by both the state and the federal court. And the court itself asked at 4 EOR 851, what other potentially exculpatory material has been withheld from disclosure? So in granting discovery, the court acknowledged, we don't know the quantum of evidence that is left that the state has failed to turn over. So you, therefore, you get to discover all of this stuff. And indeed, Mr. Snow did not receive his first disclosure of evidence from the state until April of 2006, nearly a year after mail was decided. It simply, he didn't have any reason to believe at the time that mail came out with a discovery order just issued, number one. Number two, with a standing scheduling order that stated, you shall file one final amended petition containing all of your claims for relief after discovery is completed. And indeed, the court, the federal court continued to issue orders that said that even after mail. Even after mail, the extension of time orders from the court said your amended petition should be filed after discovery was completed. So the district court clearly didn't think that mail had any impact on Mr. Snow's ability to file an amended petition. Otherwise, those orders wouldn't make sense, just as they didn't make sense in Williams. Similarly, the state clearly didn't think that Mr. Snow's amendments would be untimely because it did not assert the time bar defense until 5 years after Mr. Snow filed his amended petition. Not only that, after Mr. Snow filed his amended petition in 2007, the state stipulated to allow Mr. Snow to return to state court to exhaust his unexhausted claims because it acknowledged that he had good cause to do so. Certainly, if the state thought in 2007 that Mr. Snow's petition was untimely, it wouldn't have stipulated to allow him to return to state court for further proceedings, thereby extending the proceedings further. So it's clear from the course of conduct of the parties that everybody believed that the amendments would be timely. And it's also clear that Mr. Snow could have filed his amended petition sooner if only the state had complied with the orders. It's because... Thank you. Okay.
You want to save the remaining time?
Can I have
a question?
Can I ask just one more question?
Oh, please.
I guess I just want to hear from you why the letters and the transcript were insufficient to properly allege a Messiah claim in 2004.
Your Honor, because we had no idea that the lead detective in Mr. Snow's case was communicating with Mr. Morelli prior to him giving his statement in this case and prior to the action that happened on the record where Seton represented that certain things would happen. It was only after we found out that those prior communications were happening that we had any indication that they had actually sent him in to talk to Mr. Snow.
There still wasn't, I mean, based on what was written in the letters or and the transcript, there wasn't enough there to lead you down that path earlier?
No, Your Honor. We knew there was a Brady claim, and we raised the Brady claim, but we did not know that there was a potential Messiah claim until we knew that the lead detective was going in to solicit this information from Mr. Morelli. It was our understanding that he simply came forward with this evidence. It was only after we saw that the detective went in to speak to him before he gave his statement, and then after that, and then right before his testimony, that we were able to figure out that they had probably sent him in to obtain this information.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Connor?
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Jeffrey Connor on behalf of the respondents. As my colleague noted, there's a lot to cover in this case, so if there's a particular area where the court would prefer that I start, I'm happy to take any direction there.
I'd like to start with the Brady, who and Messiah claims. Why doesn't Cooper control here?
I think, Your Honor, Cooper doesn't control here for two reasons. First is that, and as Judge Due clarified in the motion for reconsideration on the motion to dismiss, when you look at the Nevada Supreme Court's order here, it doesn't actually apply the Brady analysis in deciding that there wasn't cause for the procedural default here. Instead, what the Nevada Supreme Court determined was that Mr. Snow had discovered the basis for the Brady allegation and did not raise it within a reasonable time, which he was required to do under state law. I don't think the Nevada Supreme Court did cite the Hathaway versus state decision in its own order, but that is a 2003 Nevada Supreme Court decision that any new evidence that would give rise to a basis for cause to overcome a procedural default has to be raised within a reasonable time. And so that was the basis for the Nevada Supreme Court's decision as to the absence of cause, was that Mr. Snow knew about the evidence and didn't raise it within a reasonable time. So it wasn't assessing the actual Brady claim itself, as opposed to what happened in Cooper, where the Nevada Supreme Court said, you know, we look at, in deciding whether or not cause and prejudice have been established, that dovetails with the elements of the Brady claim. That's not what actually happened here. The secondary thing is what counsel focused on with respect to the materiality issue here deals with an issue of prejudice. And that, in this court, in Moran, in the Moran case, acknowledged that where the state court acknowledges that it is merely addressing the merits of a claim for purposes of addressing whether or not the petitioner can establish prejudice to overcome a procedural default, that does not intertwine application of the bar with the merits of the claim. And so that doesn't affect the independence of the procedural bar.
Can I ask you, though, about on the first point you raised with respect to the Nevada Supreme Court's analysis? If I recall, the court did not separately address the Messiah claim. Am I right about that?
I think it was addressing those claims together.
Right, and that's the problem, because the rationale you just offered does not extend to the Messiah claim. Given what we just heard from your opponent, it wasn't until 2007 that they discovered the critical piece of evidence that allowed them to plausibly allege that claim.
I can remember seeing in the record where they acknowledged where they specifically found the evidence with respect to the detective visiting Mr. Morelli at the prison, and that's the actual basis for them to be able to make the Messiah claim, that they could not have alleged it before that. To the extent that's true, if that would have been, if the separation in time for the discovery of that evidence would, in the raising of the Messiah claim in state court, was made within a reasonable time, that would undermine the Nevada Supreme Court's decision. Now, but that then just becomes an error of state law that's not reviewable by this court. What would need to happen is that doesn't affect the independence of the bar. That just leads to the question of whether or not under the federal analysis there's cause to overcome the procedural bar.
So I want to explore your comments a little further, because what the court says, and as Judge Watford points out, it doesn't distinguish NAPU and Messiah. It says Brady. But then it says, well, even if there was good cause, and then it goes on to the materiality. I hear the case that you're quoting, but how is it, if the court is actually determining that these disclosures were not material, why isn't that relying on Brady?
I'm not sure that's why I said it's not relying on Brady, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that what this court said in Moran is that if a state court is analyzing a question of federal law purposes of determining prejudice in a cause and prejudice analysis, that doesn't intertwine with application of the bar. And I think that comes to a very fundamental point in how state procedural default rules work, or at least how Nevada's rules work, is that you have a state procedural bar, and then there are exceptions to the bar. So there is a decision to apply the bar. The bar is applied by the court, and then they do the analysis to see whether or not cause and prejudice can be established to get beyond the bar. The decision to apply the bar itself is not dependent on any federal question at that point. It is the federal question is whether or not they can show cause and prejudice to get past the bar. So those are two separate questions.
I understand that, but in Moran, of course, the court was quite clear what it was doing. And then you have the Cooper case. So how does your argument fit with the Cooper case?
Well, with respect to Cooper, I think that potentially you do have an intra-circuit conflict between Moran and Cooper, that Cooper would say that does intertwine the application of the bar with the Brady analysis, Moran says it wouldn't. So you potentially have an intra-circuit conflict there. That's a problem. And I can't tell you guys how to resolve it, because at least my understanding in this circuit is that the only way that can be resolved is by the en banc court, that there isn't an instruction. Some circuits say you have to follow the older decision, but my understanding is that is not the case in the Ninth Circuit. Ninth Circuit case law holds that a circuit conflict can only be resolved by the en banc court. So
you're correct about that, and then we have to figure out whether it's a conflict or whether, of course, Moran is one case and Cooper is another, and then Cooper tells us to go case by case, so that we'll have to do.
Can I ask you about Martinez?
Certainly.
You know, I'm trying to figure out if you, what you raised in the 28J letter, was whether that was waived. You failed to raise it until 1 week before the last oral argument was scheduled. And assuming it's not waived, are you saying that Snow's ineffective assistance of counsel claims are procedurally defaulted because they were not raised before January 1, 1994? Am I understanding your argument?
Well, I think if you look at this court's decision in Williams versus Filson, this court addresses that issue, and that's where I was relying on that argument from. Now, certainly the court could decide that respondents could have raised that argument earlier and didn't, and that it's forfeited as opposed to waived. I think maybe it was just overlooked as opposed to being a waiver, and that comes from, you know, in this case isn't cited in the briefing or anything like that, but Wood versus Milliard from the U.S. Supreme Court about waiver of a procedural defense versus forfeiture of just having overlooked the issue. I think that issue might have just been overlooked in briefing the procedural default issue. But as this court explained in Williams versus Filson, that, you know, there might have been, up until the Pellegrini decision was decided in 2001, there might have been some room there for petitioners to say, well, we didn't quite know how the 34-726 bar was going to apply with respect to successive petitions. But once Pellegrini was decided, that put them on notice, and they, at least after Pellegrini was decided, they needed to do something. And here, you don't have the fourth state habeas petitions not filed until 2008. That's a 7-year delay from the decision in Pellegrini till the fourth state post-conviction petition was pursued.
Yeah, but I think your colleague on the other side argued, and I guess I'd like to hear your response to that, that the state procedural bar that the Nevada Supreme Court relied on to dismiss Mr. Snow's claims was preceded by Section 177.315, which apparently imposed an identical 1-year statute of limitations. So does it really matter that Section 34.726 only took effect on January 1, 1993?
I'm not familiar with the case that my opponent referenced, that the court would want some additional briefing on that. I'd be happy to provide that. What I can say is that if you look at the Pellegrini decision itself, it breaks this down. This goes back to a very confusing aspect of Nevada law from the 70s and 80s, that there used to actually be two different post-conviction remedies. Petitioners could file a Chapter 177 petition and a Chapter 34 petition. They were two separate things, but they were both petitions for writ of habeas corpus. So the Chapter 34 bar under 34.726 was newly put into place in the early 90s when they got rid of the Chapter 177 remedy to streamline state habeas in Nevada and make it a singular remedy. So that was a new bar that was created and went into effect on January 1st, 1993, as Your Honor mentioned. And then the default from that bar doesn't occur until January 1st, 1994. They were two separate remedies. And so I'm, like I said, I'm not familiar with the case my colleague referenced that said that 177 and Chapter 34 are interchangeable. I think the Nevada Supreme Court would probably emphatically disagree with that. And that's because understanding the history of post-conviction remedies in Nevada, Chapter 177 and Chapter 34 simultaneously existed, and they were separate remedies.
About the standard under the Martinez in terms of it being a federal standard and not a state standard, whereas the court here appeared to use the state standard. What is the state's position on that?
I think my colleague is correct in the sense that the cause standard for prejudice when you're applying Martinez is a federal standard. That being the case, though, Martinez is an equitable, my alternative response to this is that Martinez is an equitable ruling. It's not a hard and fast rule. And it seems problematic to me that Martinez would create a situation where a petitioner could discover evidence to raise a new ineffective assistance of counsel claim, sit on it for a long time, not do anything with it, then raise it in state court, let the state court procedurally default it, and then use Martinez as a basis for cause to overcome the default. That seems like a problematic result to me, that Martinez is supposed to be an equitable rule, and that for a petitioner to wait 20 some odd years to raise additional claims of ineffective assistance of counsel, there has to be an end to litigation at some point in time.
You may be right about that because you raise a lot of the arguments that would counter the filing of the petition, but on a more precise level, isn't that something the district court needs to decide and not on appeal? And if you want to stand, and I appreciate your candor about the standard, you're not responsible for that. But if the wrong standard was used, why wouldn't we send it back and let the district court apply the correct standard?
Sir, I think that's probably appropriate, Your Honor. If you think that Judge Dew erred with respect to application of Martinez, that the appropriate remedy for that would be a remand to let her decide that issue. I think especially because that is a pretty fact-bound issue that would be appropriate for the district court to decide in the first instance.
Thank you.
If the court doesn't have any further questions on that step, I would like to address counsel's argument with respect to ground 10K and the ineffective assistance of counsel with respect to investigation of mitigating evidence. A lot of what counsel discussed is evidence with respect to counsel's the alleged ineffectiveness that was procedurally defaulted by the district court and is not presented on the merits in this appeal. What happened in the district court is that the vast majority of the evidence with respect to ground 10K was procedurally defaulted, with the exception of the evidence that Judge Watford referenced with respect to undercovering the plot to murder a prison guard. And then also there was some reference to two doctors from a prior criminal proceeding that had made some about mental health evaluations for Mr. Snow. One significant problem I see with that, those two aspects of the claim, excluding the procedurally defaulted evidence, certainly, you know, if the Martinez issue is going to go back to the district court, then the additional evidence may come into play, may not, depending on how the district court resolves the Martinez issue. But the issue that's presented on the merits that was decided by the Nevada Supreme Court, certainly under Penholster, in the Supreme Court's cases, in the plain language of 2254D2, you can consider evidence that was not presented to the Nevada Supreme Court when it addressed the ineffective assistance of counsel claim on appeal in Mr. Snow's first post-conviction proceeding. As a result, the two pieces of evidence that do remain, the source for those evidence, that evidence that Mr. Snow cites in his petition, is an affirmation and an affidavit that were written in 1986. It's not clear to me how it is that counsel can be ineffective for failing to find documents that haven't even been created yet. And when you look at those documents, the information that's in those documents is actually information that counsel would have needed Snow's assistance to be able to identify and find that information. We're not talking about counsel's failure to go find the court record. If you actually look at the district court record in this case and pull the post-conviction counsel's affidavit that was filed in 1986, he acknowledges that he talked with the doctor and the doctor wasn't sure that his testimony had ever even been transcribed. And I don't know that they have pointed to a transcript from the court records or anything like that where that information would have been available. Additionally, the information about undercovering the plot on the murder of the prison guard, that wasn't in, that I know of, in Mr. Snow's prison records or anything like that that they've produced. That's again referenced in another document that wasn't created until 1986. And I'm just struggling to understand how it is that counsel could be expected to find those things without Mr. Snow's assistance, which was the basis for the Nevada Supreme Court's decision on the deficient performance prong with respect to the claim that was raised in that first state post-conviction appeal. So without Snow's assistance in being able to find that evidence, counsel can't be ineffective for not finding that. One correction to make, I did in one of my 28J letter that I did file addressing ground 10K, I mistakenly said that the district court didn't err in finding that the Nevada Supreme Court reasonably applied the prejudice prong. I apologize. That was a misstatement. The Nevada Supreme Court did not address the prejudice prong with respect to 10K. I apologize for that. But I think the merits of 10K as it exists before this court fails because the Nevada Supreme Court was reasonable in determining that counsel couldn't have been expected to find that evidence without Mr. Snow's assistance.
Can I ask you about the Messiah claim, Mr. Connor?
You sure can.
Okay. It looks like you're arguing that Snow could have raised that claim based solely on the transcript of Morelli's probation hearing and the letters that the prosecutor and Detective Miller wrote to the parole board on his behalf, which he discovered, I guess, in March of 2004. I asked a corresponding question to your colleague on the other side. How could he have used the transcript, the letters, to properly allege a Messiah claim? Didn't he need to have those logs to really support his argument regarding Messiah, that this individual is being used as basically a police plant in his cell?
So it's a couple of questions or answers to that, Your Honor. I think is that first, the way that 2244 D1D works is not it's not when the evidence is actually discovered. It's when the evidence could have been discovered through the exercise of due diligence. And I'm not certain that they couldn't have gotten the logs from the CCDC earlier than they did. And so with respect to the timeliness issue, with respect to that section of the procedural bar, I don't know that that was part of it, that they needed the discovery.
Could they have?
I think they could have requested that information from the Clark County Detention Center, certainly. I don't think that was anything that the you know, certainly there's other aspects of that, you know, if this Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department knew that the detective was going to visit them and stuff, that might give rise to a Brady violation, that wasn't disclosed. But the actual basis for the Messiah claim about him going to visit, I think they could have gotten that information from the Clark County Detention Center on their own. And so I don't think that itself relieves them of on the statute of limitations thing. That the 2244 D1D is an objective standard. It's not a subjective standard. And so if they have any idea that that evidence might be out there, it's their obligation to find it. That's different than the Brady question of whether or not the state had an obligation to disclose the fact that they had communications with Mr. Morali. That's a completely different question, though, Your Honor.
Can you address equitable tolling?
Certainly. So with respect to the equitable tolling issue, I think the fact that they waited 2 years after mail was decided to file the amended petition is pretty significant. But I think there's another aspect to this that's not being addressed, and that is the Duncan versus Walker case, which was decided in the earlier in 2002, I believe, where the Supreme Court acknowledged that a pending federal habeas petition does not toll the statute of limitations. And so why it was reasonable for them to rely on a scheduling order when they know that a pending federal petition doesn't toll the statute of limitations, and then you combine that with Pace versus DiGuglielmo and the application of the decision there with respect to the fact that an untimely state petition doesn't toll because it's not properly filed, and that if you have concerns about whether or not you're going to be timely or not in state court, you can file a protected petition, and then you have mail. All these cases start stacking up.
I guess I don't see what that has to do with the main argument that your opponent is pressing, which is that they were told that you get one more shot to file your last and final petition. It must include all claims. And they could not do that until they received discovery. You all on the state side fought them tooth and nail to prevent them, or at least to delay and hinder them in getting the discovery that they ultimately were entitled to. And so it would have made no sense for them to file a half-baked petition midstream without having obtained all the discovery, only to be told, listen, counsel, I told you, you got one more shot. I don't care that you got all this unbelievably powerful evidence afterwards. You filed your one petition, and that's the end of the story.
I'm very, I understand your Honor's position, but I'm very hard-pressed to believe that after the mail decision had come out, if they had filed a motion for leave to amend that said, look, you know, this new decision came out, this changes the way that our understanding about how relation back works, we need to file this amended petition now to protect our client's rights. And, you know, that the district court would not have allowed them to do that and then subsequently file another petition when discovery was complete. I also would be hard pressed to find that a panel of this court would conclude that it wouldn't have been an abuse of discretion for the district court to not allow that to happen once mail was decided. And the final thing is that, you know, when you look at
that, if they had done that, if they had filed an amended complaint within some, you know, range of the mail decision, would it have been timely?
It wouldn't have been timely, Your Honor, but there would have been a stronger argument for equitable tolling that they had, as this court decided in Williams, that the combination of the missing, you know, all these cases start getting decided, that was because there was a lack of clarity in the law, that was a basis for them to seek equitable tolling. But once all these decisions start being made, and that put them on notice. The other thing is that in 2004, the Supreme Court decided Plyler versus Ford, where the court acknowledges that unless there's something that's affirmatively misleading in the order, then it's not a basis for tolling. And so there has to be the case that this court decided on remand and Plyler acknowledged that unless there is something false in the order itself, it's not a basis for tolling. And so their reliance on the order in this case was not reasonable in light of all these Supreme Court decisions that were telling them the statute of limitations is going to apply to you. In 2005, they know here's what the relation back standard is. And honestly, that's how relation back ought to work, is that they should have filed an amended petition through and everything that they knew that, and you have to understand, like, when you compare, like, combine this also with the standard of what they're supposed to have to do to get discovery. And Your Honor mentioned that you read those discovery orders very closely. Judge Pro is very specific about they were only allowed to do discovery on things that were tied to things that were actually in their petition.
Well, counsel, if it was so clear what the effect of mail was, then I don't understand why you all delayed for years and years and years and finally raising the statute of limitations.
Well, I think in this instance, if you look at, you know, they filed a motion for judicial notice in this case, and all the motions to dismiss where our office didn't raise the statute of limitations with respect to the relation back issue, they stopped after two mails decided in 2005. The last one, I think, was from October of 2005, where the attorney in our that filed the motion to dismiss in that case acknowledged that he wasn't going to raise mail because he acknowledged that there was a good estoppel argument there from the other side that we had acquiesced in this pattern of conduct for years, and we can't raise that now. But then here, you know, he went back to state court and litigated his petition in state court. Could we have said it's untimely, there's no need to do a stay? Like, certainly we could have, but I don't think that waives the defense, Your Honor.
But it kind of touched your argument that everything was so crystal clear that any competent lawyer in their position would have known to do X or Y. It just strikes me as it confirms the reasonableness of everything they did.
I don't think it has to be only a competent. This is the only conclusion a competent lawyer would reach. It's a reasonableness question, and that they have to be reasonably diligent in protecting their rights when you're looking at equitable tolling. I think this is a situation where both prongs of the equitable tolling analysis kind of collapse into each other, because he has to show that he's being reasonably diligent in protecting his rights. And so that's another thing here, Your Honor, is that even assuming this court concludes that the orders and everything would give rise to a basis for tolling, I think there probably needs to be a remand to the district court to assess diligence all the way through filing. It's an area where I think that all collapses together, and I don't know that it's the standard is that the only conclusion to reach. It's that it has to be reasonable for them to rely on that, and I just don't see that that it was reasonable at that point in time.
Mr. Snow filed his March 13, 2003 amended petition pro se, I believe. It was not until the court appointed the federal defenders as his counsel that he filed his amended petition. Does the fact that he was proceeding pro se excuse his failure in any way to meet the 1 year statute of limitations? Is that a factor?
I don't think it's a factor. One, I would acknowledge that if you look at the signature page on that 2003 petition, it's actually signed by an attorney. It was one of the state post-conviction attorneys from the third state post-conviction action actually signed the petition. I see that I'm over my time. If I could,
oh no, please
finish answering. It doesn't. That may be a factor with respect to the 2003 issue, but I think that at this point is a non-factor because of the Williams decision. I think Judge Due's analysis is consistent with this court's decision in Williams, and so because of the lack of clarity in the law with respect to Duncan and Pace versus DiGuglielmo, his 2003 petition is entitled to equitable tolling. And so the pro se aspect of it, I don't think comes into play there. And it's not an issue with respect to the 2007 amended petition, of course, because the federal public defender had been representing him for 3 years at that point.
Thank you. If no further questions, thank you, Mr. Connor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Burley?
Hello, Your Honors. Can you hear me? I just want to make sure I'm not muted. Thank you. So, Your Honors, to the tolling point, the state has just conceded that they declined to raise a timeliness argument in a capital case in the District of Nevada, even after mail was decided. Clearly, the state did not believe at the time that petitioners would be untimely, and there was still a lack of clarity for petitioners like Mr. Snow, whose AEDPA time expired before mail was decided, as to what they were supposed to do to ensure relation back. Here, it was reasonable for Mr. Snow to believe, based on the district court's orders, that it was not appropriate for him to file an amended petition until after his discovery was completed. He was clearly diligent in litigating the discovery. It was the state who prolonged those proceedings for so long by failing to comply with the orders. And so, for all of the reasons that we've stated today and in our briefing, we do believe that we're entitled to tolling. Turning now to the Messiah issue, Your Honors, the state is literally relying on its own failure to turn over the evidence to support its argument that the claim was untimely. Mr. Snow did not and could not obtain the visitation logs from CCDC until January of 2007. And I would note that is only after Mr. Snow was forced to file multiple motions to compel the state to turn over the evidence. The state cannot hide evidence and then blame a petitioner for failing to raise a claim on the basis of that evidence any sooner. Similarly, as it relates to the Messiah claim, whether he would have been on notice because there was a Brady violation that he needed to file a Messiah claim, if that was true, every time a petitioner had a Brady claim, they would be required to also file a Messiah claim just in case. There was no evidence of a Messiah violation in this case until we had the logs. We could not get the logs until the state finally was forced to turn them over. And as soon as the discovery proceedings were completed, we filed the petition within less than 2 months after we received all the discovery. So for that reason, that claim ought to be deemed timely. And when it relates to this issue of the intertwining, clearly under Cooper v. Nevin, the issue was intertwined. We would argue that Foster v. Chapman and the Supreme Court's decision in Ripo indicate that what the state said in, or what the, this court said in Moran about intertwining is no longer true in Nevada as it relates to Brady claims. Clearly, reviewing the merits under RIPPO as part of the default ruling makes them to be intertwined and means that the default bar is not independent. Turning to the ineffective assistance mitigation issue, Your Honor, there's no pinholster problem here as it relates to the penalty, to the prejudice prong, because this court is doing de novo review. It is beyond dispute that the Nevada Supreme Court did not review the prejudice prong of the Strickland argument. Its holding was entirely based on deficient performance. Because this court's review of the prejudice prong is de novo, it is entitled to consider all of the evidence under this court's holdings in Murray v. Schreiro, among others. Anyway, the transcript from the 1970 proceeding that we're primarily relying on today was presented to the Nevada Supreme Court. State Post-Conviction Counsel obtained that transcript and presented it to the state court. If you look at EOR 5722, you will see counsel's motion to the state district court where he attempts to present that transcript. The state district court refuses to consider the transcript. And then if you look at EOR 5375, you will see the appendix that state post-conviction counsel attached to his briefing to the Nevada Supreme Court. And in that appendix, you will see that that transcript is included. So the transcript we rely on was contained within that. And so for all those reasons, the state has conceded we're entitled to a remand, at least on the Martinez and tolling issues, and we would ask this court to do so, and to also find that Mr. Snow is entitled to a new penalty hearing.
Thank you. Thank you, both counsel, both for the argument today and the briefing. The case just argued of John Oliver Snow versus Baker is submitted, and we're adjourned for the afternoon. Thank you.